Today's Wednesday, the 7th of July, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The United States says that more than 90% of its troops have left Afghanistan.
This isn't really surprising if you think about it. The largest U.S. base was handed over just a few days ago.
Plus, pressure is mounting on Lebanon's interim prime minister to form a government. And celebrating the golden age of Arab music and cinema. We'll have these stories and more next. According to information released by the U.S. Central Command on Tuesday, the United States has completed withdrawing more than 90% of its forces from Afghanistan. Joining us with the details about the U.S. troop drawdown is VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb.
Well, yes, U.S. Central Command, as you said, says that they are 90% complete with their U.S. military troop withdrawal. This isn't really surprising if you think about it. The largest U.S. base, Bagram Airfield, which has served for nearly two decades as the center of the U.S. fight to remove Taliban forces from power and also take down the Al-Qaeda terrorists responsible for killing Americans, that base was handed over just a few days ago. And so once that base was handed over, the expectation was that that was the big bulk of this withdrawal. There are still some concentrated forces in Kabul. The U.S. is going to be ultimately transitioning from where it is now to just providing security for the embassy. And then also, until there is a solution for the airport, they're going to be helping out the Turks provide security for the airport in Kabul as well. So not a big shocker, but it is good to know that they are that close to being complete. There is a caveat to that, though. Let me tell you, because just because they're 90% complete does not mean that you're going to be seeing the U.S. saying that they're finished in the next few days. We asked that to several U.S. officials, and they say that the expectation now is that the U.S. will be done with their withdrawal by August.
Carla, I wanted to ask you about Bagram Air Base, because over the weekend, there was some reporting that the new Afghan commander of the air base was not aware that the United States was withdrawing. Has the Pentagon made any comments about that particular situation?
Yes. Yeah, so before the U.S. Independence Day holiday, VOA was able to confirm, we were actually one of the first to confirm shortly after the Associated Press, that the U.S. had handed over Bagram to Afghan forces. We announced it even before the Afghan ministry, I think, had put it out on Twitter. But over the last several days, we realized that it wasn't as easy as a handover as we initially expected it to be. And I asked Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby about that today. And he told me, when I asked, was this not a huge oversight? He goes, well, I can't tell you how the Afghan military and the Afghan civilian leaders trickled down this information, basically. But he said, what I can say is that there was a deliberate handover, and that within 48 hours, around 48 hours before the U.S. vacated this base, there was even a walkthrough of the base. So in his view, and in the Pentagon's view, the Afghans were very aware of what was happening. There's been a couple of other things that we're looking into as well. We were told that the electricity went out once the U.S. left. Apparently, it looks like some of the generators were shut off when the Americans left. We're trying to figure out how this happened. Was this an oversight as well? Did no one explain how to keep the generators running? Was this intentional? There are still a lot of questions that need to be answered. But the biggest question was, why were the Afghans not more prepared for this? And why did the U.S. not feel like it could share full details about when they were leaving Bagram? And Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby told me and other reporters that basically this was operational security, and that while it wasn't a contested withdrawal, they had to prepare as if the Taliban could find out and could try to attack.
Carla Babb is VOA's Pentagon correspondent. For more on how the withdrawal of U.S. and NATO forces is impacting Afghanistan and its future, VOA's Yalda Bakhtash spoke with Ambassador Melanie Verveer, the executive director of the Georgetown Institute for Women, Peace, and Security via Skype. Ambassador Verveer previously served as the first U.S. ambassador for global women's issues.
There can be no solution through military means, through the Taliban doing what they are apparently doing now in terms of continuing to fight and take territory. They will never be recognized internationally. This needs to be a political settlement. There needs to be an agreement on the terms going forward. Of course, the Taliban right now don't feel they have any incentive to do that. And I think you're right. All kinds of pressure have to be applied to get them to negotiate, because that is the only way to reasonably create the kind of political agreement that's necessary to guarantee the future arrangements about Afghanistan that matter so much.
Ambassador, more than 9 months has passed since, you know, the intra-Afghan negotiation has started in Doha in Qatar. But the Taliban's stance towards Afghan women's rights and minorities' rights and human rights in general doesn't seem to be changed that much. Are you at all concerned about Taliban gaining power and also the peace process in general, and how it could ensure that the human rights would be an important part of the process?
Well, absolutely. And the peace process, if it can be rekindled in a way that follows the kinds of guidelines that need to be met, where the red lines, the absolutely fundamental red lines, are on the table to ensure that the rights of women and minorities, which are so precarious under the Taliban, that they get full consideration and that they are viewed as absolutely fundamental, not anything that is going to be negotiated and negotiated without them. Their participation has to be meaningful participation. There are no negotiations if they are sidelined negotiations that will matter. And yes, it's a matter of grave concern because the Taliban have said repeatedly that they are going to implement their version of Islam. Of course, it's a very radical, extremist version when it comes to women, and not one that one finds in any other predominantly Muslim country. This is something that they alone in their radical definition are executing to set up an emirate with everything that that represents. So there is plenty reason to be worried. And I know they've said again in the last few days that they respect women. Well, the reality is where they have had control under current circumstances, they have been closing girls' schools and they have been acting in a way that is extremely contrary to that statement. And moreover, we have had this continuing stream of violent actions that have taken away the lives of women. So this to many of us is an absolutely critical point. And so, yes, there have to be negotiations. Yes, there has to be a political settlement. But that political settlement cannot come on the backs of the Afghan women and cannot be done without their meaningful participation. They have to be part. They are a critical part of the future of Afghanistan.
Ambassador Melanie Verveer is the executive director of the Georgetown Institute for Women, Peace, and Security. She was speaking with VOA's Yalda Bakhtash. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. Lebanon's caretaker Prime Minister Hassan Diab warns of another explosion that could hit his country as tensions rise, with angry citizens waiting in line for hours at stations for meager gas supplies, while others scour pharmacies for unavailable medicine and baby formula. Analysts say that power outages and a currency devaluation of 90% add to the Lebanese woes during this long, hot summer. Pressure is mounting on Prime Minister-designate Saad Hariri to quickly form a cabinet, something that's been unachievable for nearly a year. Dale Gavlak is up next.
Lebanese protested Tuesday outside the energy ministry, calling their government's electricity rationing harsh by only providing power a couple of hours a day. The shortage and the sweltering heat is fraying nerves, but also putting hospitalized patient lives at risk, especially as the Delta variant of the COVID-19 hits. Professor Habib Malik of the Lebanese American University tells VOA the political elite supported by the Iranian-backed Hezbollah militia are to blame for Lebanon's continuing dark descent.
It's multiple parallel catastrophes. Pharmacies have no medicines. Medications are very scarce, especially ones for chronic ailments. And this is endangering the entire population. Grocery shelves are empty. Prices are going through the roof. Fuel and other energy is scarce. It's a disaster. And much of it is completely unnecessary, but actually it's the result of a Ponzi scheme that this criminal mafia protected by the armed militia has perpetrated on Lebanon. And nobody in the world seems to care. Everybody knows what's going on. They just sit there.
Writing in the Saudi Arab News, Baria Alamedin says hospitals are receiving only about 2 to 3 hours of electricity from the grid. There is no fuel for generators, in part because so much subsidized fuel is smuggled to Syria. Observers say that government-subsidized medicine and other goods are also smuggled to neighboring Syria. Alamedin warns that priority life and death institutions are a step away from grinding to a complete halt. Critical electronic systems at airport customs, the Ministry of Justice, and public security centers have failed in recent days because of electricity and supply shortages. Sunni Muslim Prime Minister-designate Saad Hariri has been at loggerheads with Hezbollah-backed President Michel Aoun over the formation of a new government to tackle reforms demanded by the international community to release some $300 million in badly needed funds. But Professor Malik says that Hariri himself is unable to fulfill the task due to his own political baggage.
Hariri has all kinds of lawsuits pending. If the immunity of his position as prime minister designate is somehow canceled, he has problems with Turkey and Saudi Arabia locally. If he is actually permitted to form a government, we don't know if he will. The forces arrayed against him have been paralyzing the whole process, principally Aoun and his son-in-law. Hezbollah doesn't seem to care or want to do anything about this.
The United Nations says unemployment is estimated at more than 40%, while the majority of Lebanese can't afford to adequately feed themselves. The financial crisis is posing the gravest threat to Lebanon's stability since the 15-year civil war ended in 1990. Dale Gavlak for VOA News, Amman.
Russian authorities say the country is facing a surge in new coronavirus infections, and as Charles Maines reports, it has prompted a renewed effort to convince a skeptical public that the time is now to vaccinate.
Having once claimed victory over the coronavirus, Russia is now struggling again. A growing crisis fueled by the new Delta strain of the virus and Russians' reluctance to vaccinate. Just 12% of Russia's population has been vaccinated thus far, say experts, despite the government having unveiled its Sputnik V vaccine to much fanfare at the beginning of the year.
We at Russia do have a functional vaccine, and so the fact that people in Russia are not getting it en masse is a huge misunderstanding of some sort, and I really hope that changes.
Infection rates have tripled in the past few weeks, with Moscow hit hardest. Moscow Mayor Sergei Sobyanin says the new Delta strain now accounts for nearly 90% of all new coronavirus cases, and with it, a new death record toll that is likely to rise, say experts.
Definitely more people are going to die if they do not vaccinate before we beat this disease.
That grim reality has forced authorities to reintroduce restrictions, ending months of near normalcy. Cafes and restaurants are only open for the vaccinated or those who can prove they're healthy with a government-issued digital QR code. State entities and service sector businesses must also ensure at least 60% of staff are vaccinated within a month, forcing some to choose between their job or the needle.
Like most people, I'm here because my employer said I had to get vaccinated.
Half a year after the vaccine's arrival, the demand for Sputnik V is finally palpable, say health workers.
We've been working here since January 19th, quite some time. But in the past week, we've seen those wishing to get vaccinated increase threefold.
President Vladimir Putin has joined the campaign, ending months of speculation to say he too was vaccinated by Russia's Sputnik V out of the public eye. But polls show widespread resistance to vaccination persists, and the Kremlin has quietly abandoned its goal of inoculating 60% of the population by the fall. Meanwhile, authorities have allowed some high-profile public events to go ahead, despite the surge in infections. It's a mixed messaging that some fear undercuts the government's coronavirus response and legitimate efforts to contain the contagion spread. Charles Maines for VOA News, Moscow.
With rising vaccinations and infection rates falling, Turkey has lifted nearly all COVID-19 restrictions. After months of severe restrictions, the country is seeking to return to normalcy. Dorian Jones takes it from here.
Preparations for a busy night at Istanbul's Aida restaurant. For the owners and staff, it's been a long battle for survival. For more than a year, the restaurant had either been closed as part of COVID lockdowns or operating under strict controls, limiting the number of customers and hours. Owner Elif Ulaham is now taking reservations. She says the lifting of restrictions came just in time.
We feel that we can make it now. We were really in a desperate state during the last lockdown, especially. If we work 2 years in a row without restrictions, we can turn back to being, let's say, where we were a year ago before the pandemic. But it's hopeful right now in this sense. I mean, we're a small business, so it's easier for us to pick our pace up.
The lifting of restrictions come after infection rates have fallen by 90%. The result, the government says, of an aggressive vaccination campaign, coupled with strict controls. After delays in procuring vaccines, Turkey's health ministry says it's vaccinating as many as 1 million people a day. But some doctors voice concern about the reopening, especially with the Delta variant now in Turkey. But the end of the lockdowns is more than welcomed by people desperate to return to normalcy.
I am feeling very well, as after almost 2 years, we are at a cultural activity in the open air, in beautiful weather. This is the first such event in 2 years. We haven't attended any before this.
After more than a year of evening and weekend curfews and most entertainment venues closed, people in Istanbul's Kadıköy Entertainment Quarter seem only too willing to seize the opportunity for a night out. Returning to normalcy is bittersweet for some.
We are happy on one side, but when we came back, we saw that many friends, many business neighbors were not able to open, and this made us very sad. So on the one hand, being able to socialize again, having Kadıköy's spirit back, made us happy, while on the other hand, we are sad about these closures.
But the lifting of controls came with a catch. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan announcing a midnight music ban in bars, claiming people shouldn't be disturbed. That has prompted howls of protest. But the controversy appears to have done little to dampen the spirits of those determined to celebrate. Dorian Jones of VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
The U.S. Pacific Northwest is finally cooling down after recently experiencing extreme temperatures in places like Seattle and Portland, caused by what is known as a heat dome. According to NOAA's National Ocean Service, a heat dome is caused by a mass of high-pressure air stuck over a region. While such air would normally be moved along by a jet stream, it was unable to move the mass of high-pressure hot air that hung over the region. Seattle recorded temperatures of 42 degrees Celsius on June 28th before cooler, wetter marine air swept into the coastal city that night, bringing temperatures back down to the lower 20s. Much of the interior part of the region did not see a drop in temperature until July 1st, and the region is expected to completely cool through this week. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet welcomes efforts by Venezuela's government to improve human rights standards in the country, but says they do not go far enough. Bachelet has submitted her report to the UN Human Rights Council, and Lisa Schlein has more.
The government of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro has announced several new initiatives, including reforms of the country's police and justice system. That seemingly has resulted in a downward trend in alleged deaths during protests and security operations. However, a UN Rights Chief, Michelle Bachelet, says every death is one too many. In line with the spirit of the announced reforms, she calls on the government to assure accountability for past and present killings of protesters. Bachelet says social protests are continuing because of a lack of access to basic services and persistent socioeconomic inequalities that, she says, is compounded by the impact of unilateral sectoral sanctions and the COVID-19 pandemic. She speaks through an interpreter.
Conditions of detention continue to give rise to concern, all the more so in the context of the COVID-19 pandemic. Access to adequate food, water, sanitation, and healthcare must be guaranteed to all. I welcome the imminent closure of all detention facilities run by the intelligence services, a step announced by the president.
Regarding judicial reform, Bachelet calls on the government to ensure people charged with a crime have the right to a fair trial, including unrestricted access to a lawyer of his or her choosing and guarantees of an independent, impartial tribunal. She says restrictions on civic space also are an issue of great concern. She speaks through an interpreter.
I highlight in particular the stigmatization, criminalization, and threats against dissenting voices, particularly towards civil society, media, and members of the opposition. From June 2020 to May of this year, my office documented 97 such incidents related to human rights defenders.
Bachelet notes most were charged with criminal offenses for taking part in legitimate forms of civic engagement. Venezuela's ambassador to the UN in Geneva, Hector Constant Rosales, condemns the report, saying it is based on double standards. He says his country complies with international legal standards of human rights that, he said, despite being under enormous pressure due to the financial sanctions imposed by the United States. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A court in Belarus has jailed a former rival of President Alexander Lukashenko. Reuters' Lucy Fielder explains.
A court in Belarus has jailed former presidential contender Viktor Babariko for 14 years. It convicted him on Tuesday on corruption charges he denied, sparking condemnation from the West and the exiled opposition. Babariko was arrested last June. Before that, polls suggested he was the main rival of veteran President Alexander Lukashenko, ahead of an election last August, one which the embattled opposition says was rigged to prolong Lukashenko's rule. In power since 1994, Lukashenko claimed a landslide victory and a new presidential term, sparking the biggest protests in the history of Belarus, an ex-Soviet republic backed by Moscow. Ahead of Tuesday's ruling, Babariko's allies said the charges against him were fabricated to thwart his political ambitions. Svetlana Tikhanovskaya, a protest leader who fled Belarus amid a post-election crackdown, called it an insane term for a man who woke the country from a long sleep. The US embassy in Minsk said Lukashenko would stop at nothing to keep a grip on power, calling the court system a cruel sham.
Lucy Fielder of Reuters News. UN investigator Anais Marin says Belarus has suffered an unprecedented human rights crisis since the August 9th presidential election that's widely viewed as being fraudulent. Over the past year, she notes that more than 35,000 people have been arbitrarily detained for exercising their right to freedom of peaceful assembly or in support of victims of abuse. And finally, the golden age of Arab cinema and music of the 20th century is being revisited through its female stars, from Orhem Kaltoum to Fairuz and Dalida, women who became powerful symbols of feminism, Arab independence, and identity. Lisa Bryan has more on Divas, an exhibit at the Arab World Institute in Paris that runs through September 26th.
Through film and music clips, posters, and mementos, the Divas exhibit traces the Arab world's female artistic scene from the 1920s to the 70s. It includes singers like Egypt's legendary Kalsoum and Fairuz from Lebanon, actresses like Suad Hosni and Hind Rustam, also dancers, producers, and directors. Those stars and the times they lived in embodied much more than art.
Women in the Arabic world fight for live their life, fighting for obtain more rights, And it was a woman fight. Woman for woman.
Elodie Bouffard is co-curator of the exhibit at the Arab World Institute.
This exhibition is here just to say, okay, at this time, this industry was very strong and was an industry where women had their place inside.
Few stars occupied such a big place or left such a big hole as Egypt's Umm Kulthum. She remains arguably the Arab world's greatest singer, whose albums sold by the millions. She was also an actress and songwriter. Like many of this exhibit's divas, she came from a humble background.
She was a little poor Egyptian woman from the delta of the Nile. And just because she was a great singer, she had the opportunity to go to Cairo, and she completely understand that she had to accept a metamorphosis to live her life, because her daddy was an imam. So when she was in Cairo, she asked her daddy to go to come back in the delta, and she said, okay, don't worry, I can give you some money, you can have a great life, but please let me become what I want to become.
Umm Kulthum sang in support of Egypt's nationalist leader, Gamal Abdel Nasser. In Lebanon, Christian singer Firouz, now in her 80s, is known for her fierce love for her country and Arab identity, seen in this song on Jerusalem.
She sings from Jerusalem, but she can just make a song for the Hajj, the pilgrimage to Mecca, for the Muslim. So she just go through religious identity to embody the pride to be an Arab.
Other Arab stars broke different kinds of ground. French-born Warda championed Algeria's fight for independence from France. She later divorced to pursue her singing career. Syrian singer Asmahan smoked, drank, and had lovers, and allegedly was a World War II spy. There was also Egyptian-born Dalida, who became a major hit in France.
It's really, really impressive to see that the Arab world had that many pioneers, women pioneers, who were like really powerful women who did know what they wanted, who were producers as well as spouses, and they were beautiful women that really make the Arab world proud of them.
That's a reaction of visitor Zahira wandering through the exhibit on a rainy afternoon.
Je suis très intéressée par la culture orientale.
Another visitor, Joelle Bouche, says she wanted to see this exhibit because she's interested in Middle East culture and because it's about women. The show begins with the early Arab stars, those Bouffard calls the forgotten divas.
They were the first to go on stage. They were the first to be a producer, the first actress, the first feminist who came on the street and said, ah, we want more rights.
These 20th century divas can appear a clash with more conservative Arab society today, at least by Western standards, and charges of cultural repression in places like Egypt. Still, Bouffard believes female Arab artists are finding new ways to express themselves, just as they did in the past. For VOA News, this is Lisa Bryant in Paris.
And that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.